Hey James, thank you so much for hopping on our show. Can you give us a little bit of background about yourself? I know you have a fairly extensive and a very interesting background. Can you share a little bit about your life, what you've been through, and how you got yourself to where you are today?
Well, I am a retired pastor of over 32 years at the same church in Durham County, North Carolina, out in a little place called Bahama, where I pastored about a membership of about 200 on Sundays, around about 75 to 75 members. I grew up in a small town outside of Raleigh, about 30 miles, Lewisburg, North Carolina. I went to high school, finished, and went off to college, got my undergraduate degree, and 1 year of law school at the same time as I entered into law school on the combined program. Finished law school in 1969. I started practicing law in 1971. Became the first African-American lawyer to practice in my hometown, first and only at the time. I was the youngest African-American lawyer practicing in the state of North Carolina. I practiced for about 10 years, but in the process, I started gambling, began to win money, lost money, but then I fell in love with it and started going downhill. And I did something that I would always regret, and after losing monies, losing all of the properties that I gained, my home, my wife for 5 years, I did a stupid thing by robbing a bank. And of course, after robbing the bank, I pled guilty, received a 15-year sentence, and of that 15-year sentence, I spent 5 years in the correctional institution been so long ago, I'm almost forgetting where I was. but that's a good thing.
Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
Yeah. In Ashland, Kentucky. And then, of course, I left there after 4 years and spent a year in the camp at Petersburg. Got out in 1986. I began to pull my life back together and went back to school, went to seminary, received my Master's of Divinity, my Doctor of Ministry. And in the midst of all of that, I was called to my church. And of course, I stayed at this church for a little over 32 years. I just retired back in December. And of course, I started a podcast about a year ago. And that has been basically my life. In the midst of all of this, I was able to get back to do some work with the State Bar. So the State Bar allowed me to be a sponsor of CLE, Ethics and Mental Health and Substance Abuse, which I did for 11 years. I only stopped doing it when COVID came in because I didn't want to travel all over the state when COVID was here. So that's kind of my life story in a nutshell. you can, you know, ask me any questions you want to. I always tell people that my life is an open book. I have no problem with sharing. I'm just a person who feels that what I can share can always help somebody else. And even when I started my podcast, I wanted to be about encouraging, inspiring, and transforming. So that's what I've done. And I've been really doing well with it, enjoying it, and I'm living a fulfilled life. I remarried to a lovely wife. Matter of fact, the past July was 33 years, 2 kids, and 2 grandkids, 2 daughters, 2 granddaughters, rather. And they're doing well. I'm doing well. And what else can I say about life?
Hey, everyone. We've been using Furnish Finder for the last 5 years. When it comes to travel nursing assignments or long-term vacations, Furnish Finder is a place to go. One of the most stressful aspects about travel nursing is finding housing. There aren't a lot of sites that offer furnished homes for short-term leasing. Furnish Finder has thousands of furnished properties nationwide to meet your every need. If you're looking for a 1-bedroom studio to a 3-bedroom family home, Furnished Finder has you covered. Travel with a peace of mind with Furnished Finder. Start your search at furnishedfinder.com. Yeah, James, well, congrats on the happy family, all the kids and everything like that. Sounds like your life's very interesting, but definitely filled with some highs, some lows. And I really appreciate you coming out and sharing, because the best way for us to learn is firstly from our mistakes, but then secondly from other people's mistakes. So I'm glad you're open about sharing it, because people could definitely learn a lot from what you've been through, what's happened to you, and just your whole life story. So going from lawyer to gambler, how did that transition happen? What really made you could say, fake fall in love with gambling? Because when I watch YouTube, I see a lot of people promoting gambling sites, all that kind of stuff, like casino games, all those kind of things. I do myself play some poker like once a week, just for fun. But I see a lot more of these gambling commercials, gambling sponsors. And in my head, when I first thought of that, I'm like, you got these big platforms promoting gambling and to the wide public. And you have kids, people that are 18 years old that not really sure what they're getting themselves into. But playing poker, I understand the rush of winning a hand or winning some chips or, gambling and winning. And it does become a little bit addicting. So you do have to control yourself in a sense that it's easy to fall in the trap of just chasing that gambling high. So what really made you fall into that trap of gambling? And how did you transition from a lawyer to having this issue with gambling?
Well, that's a very good question. And I'll answer this way. Even at a young age, in middle school, my uncle was played a gambler. He played cards. And I would go over to his house and spend the nights with his wife and their kids. And while at his house, they would start some little card game. And so I learned basically how to play every card game you could possibly think of, okay? And of course, obviously, my mom was living in New York, so she would always send me a little spending change. And so I had always had a little spending change, and we would play for nickels, dimes, or whatever. That wasn't a problem. It was just fun. I gambled with pool, became a really, what I would call a pool shop. Even during my senior year in high school, going through college, I always liked to do that. But I never had a problem with it. It was okay. I was fine with it. Got out of law school and started practicing law, and I was working with some lawyers who every Wednesday, I noticed they were not in the office. And so I asked the secretary, where are they? Every Wednesday, they would leave. And she said, well, they're just right across the streets, man. They got a little poker game into. And so I said, oh, okay. And he said, you can go over there with him and check him out. So one Wednesday, I just walked across the street where it was playing, and they asked me to, look, you want to learn this game? I said, yeah. And I started playing poker. Well, you know, being someone who would always gamble, but pool with all kinds of cards, it was another little interest that I had, and I kind of fell in love with it. I liked it. And of course, they started playing for pretty large size money. And of course, as I learned the game, I became more fascinated. I thought I was getting pretty good. I won money. I lost money. It was no problem because we always gamble with professionals. They were the lawyers, bondsmen, you know, barbers in the areas. So nobody ever got broke that didn't get some money. So, and that might have been one of the problems that we were facing because we were always able to get more money. So if I, you know, lost all I had and I needed to borrow another $500, I could get it. Same thing with them. If I was a winner that night and they needed another $500,000, they got it. Okay. That's the way we played. So we were up and down. We actually made money gambling. We lost money gambling, but it was just fun. We had a little circle and we went to different homes. And of course it was just like really good therapy because the spouses or the girlfriends of the guys would have big spreads, would have all kind of drinks. And so you ate and you took a drink. If you were tired and sleepy, you took your nap and you got up and, you know, once you rested out, you got back into the game and somebody else lost some money. They got up and did the same thing. And we could do that all the whole weekend. And that's what we did. You know, I've left the office on a Friday evening, and went to a pool game and didn't get back until early Monday morning. That's just the way we play. And it was really fun. Oh, you know, everybody was okay. Until it got to another point in my life, it was like I began to have the love for it. It was just like I didn't know when to get up, when to stop. It wasn't like that when I first got started, but then it got to that place that I was just wanted to be there. I just kept playing. And until I knew anything, you know, I was going downhill. You know, I borrowed money. I bought money on homes. I bought money from loan sharks. I did all of this kind of stuff until actually I had basically lost everything. I always say I went straight to the bottom. And that's when I committed this awesome, gruesome crime that I, you know, will always regret. But, I, you know, I'm over it. I don't wallow in it. And so that's how it happened. But I always thought I was a compulsive gambler. And so when I wrote my first book, Deal By Me, A Golden Opportunity to Blow, I talked about it because I thought I was a compulsive gambler. But then in the midst of all of it after I was out, I didn't go to a place, but I did call Gambling Anonymous, then a place here in Chapel Hill, where a lot of the guys, women went who had considered themselves compulsive gamblers. And it operated very much like Gambling Anonymous. It's not, I mean, Alcohol Anonymous. It was basically Gambling Anonymous. And when I called a guy, I told him I would like to come over and talk to the people. First thing he asked me was, he said, are you still a compulsive gambler? And I said, no. And he said to me, well, I don't know if the guys would appreciate hearing from you because we believe that once a gambler, always a gambler. Well, I knew that was not me, okay? Because I knew that I had no urge for it anymore. You know, it was all over. I had not gambled since 1981. So I knew it was it. So in writing my second book, what I call the second edition of The Deal by Me, and I gave it a subtitle of self-evaluation, and I was really doing it was like talking about what I learned from what I went through. And I concluded that my problem was not a compulsive gambler, but my problem was I was afraid to fail. And that's where I ended up at. And I came to that conclusion, you know, as a result, I had been this first and only African-American lawyer practicing in my hometown. I was the youngest African-American lawyer practicing in North Carolina. I mean, everybody was looking up to me. I'm not boasting, but I was an excellent lawyer. I had good clients. I was making good money. But the gambling caused me to lose everything, and I just saw myself at the bottom, and I couldn't take it. It was just like I didn't want to fail, and I thought that what I did would get me right back up, that I could take the money, pay off debts, and I could get started right back off again, and everything would be fine. Now, I know that's not the way it would work, but that's my thinking at that particular time, and so that's what happened to me. It's something, you know, I wish it was different, but, you know, you can't go back and put the water back in the jar. You know, it's already been spilled. So I deal with it and I work, and I must say my life is great. I'm doing some great things. I've been blessed. So I don't have any real complaints. There are many times in my life when I feel as if this is really where I'm supposed to be anyway. So I'm comfortable. I still got all my good friends. I have lawyer friends who knew me when I was practicing law. They're still my friends. We still eat together. We go out together. We have fun talking. They call me one of the people who died or got sick or something. We all go to the funeral together. So we're all good friends. I got a good ministers and pastors, and they are good friends of mine. So I'm living the joy of my life. I'm really having a great time. So I can't complain about anything.
And James, you said that with your self-reflection, you kind of realized that and found out that you're really scared of failure. But it seems to me like you're also a person that likes to take on some risks, right? Becoming a lawyer is very risky. Every trial is a new risk. You have a chance of winning, chance of losing. There's always some stakes in a trial of being a lawyer. You like gambling. So with the whole bank robbery situation, if you're okay sharing, you said at that point you hit rock bottom. That's what you found to be almost like the best solution for you to get out of it. So in your mindset, how did you come to that conclusion? Why did you think that was like your only way out or your best chance?
I didn't think of that at the time. It wasn't anything that I premeditated. It was something that kind of happened on a spread of the moment, and I don't mind telling you how it happened. I'd almost committed suicide. Okay, that's what I was thinking. When I got up in the morning to go to my office, I didn't even feel like I was going to leave my office. I had pulled the pistol out of my drawer. I had it with me, and I went and sat in the office in the chair, just contemplating my whole life. I'm here at the bottom. I lost everything. I can't see my way out, and I just started riding around. And of course, many times I contemplated, and I guess if I wasn't an only child, and my mom was not in the picture, and my thinking about her, I probably would have done it. But that kind of kept me a little focused. And so I just started writing. And I rode into a town called Oxford, North Carolina. And I was eating in the restaurant. And because it was later in the morning, breakfast time now, and I'm riding around because I couldn't sit in the office and my mind is just gone. And I'm sitting in the restaurant. And while I'm eating, I look out of the window and I see the Central Carolina Bank. That was the name of it at the time, Central Carolina Bank. And then my mind started rolling. You know, it just started rolling. Boy, if I could just, you know, get enough money to pay off these debts, to do this, do that, and to just get things started love again. So it wasn't a long premeditation moment. It was just a spread of the moment to do it, get it over with. Hopefully can get by, not get caught, and then I'm okay. That's the way it worked. That's the way I was looking at it. Now, that's not the way it worked, but that's the way I was looking at it. And of course, obviously, that didn't work out.
Almost like in a way, like an act of desperation, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it was.
Mm. And you mentioned you went into like the gambling anonymous kind of stuff. So why was it hard for you to maybe find help out outside of that? Because like you mentioned again, you said that your fear of failure. A lot of times I struggle with that too, in a sense that with the fear of failure is that sometimes we feel like only we could fix this and it's our responsibility to fix it. And that's sometimes why we don't reach out to others for help. When we know that if we reach out, people are going to help us. We just don't want to reach out because we then almost look at ourselves as a bigger failure, because now I'm almost putting this burden on you because you got to help figure out my situation. So you even feel worse. Did you have like the same feelings?
You are so interesting. I'm listening to you talk and it's really about where I was. And I hear you so well. I've said to my wife now that I know I could have gone to my relatives, my granddaddy. My granddaddy owned no 500 acres of land. I could have gone to my aunts or anybody and saying, look, you know, I'm head over heels in debt. You know, I just need, you know, $50,000, and I can just take care of everything, and I'll eventually get it back to you. I just honestly believe if they knew that about me, they would have let me have it. But my thoughts were, and when you said what you're saying is exactly where it was, my thought was, you know, they were looking up to me. You know, I was this lawyer in the family, the only one, you know, only a lawyer in the family. But they thought I had it all together. And so to go to them for anything in my mind was not only letting myself down, but I was letting them down too. And I didn't want to do that. Okay. Mm-hmm. So when you said that, it really kind of made me laugh because it's really was where I was, you know. So I definitely know exactly what you say. And that's kind of was my feeling. You know, I could not go to my family members and just ask them to do this for me. It just, my thought was they're going to be saying, why are you doing, you know, you're the lawyer. You shouldn't be having to go through this. And, you know, they are farmers and what have you. It's just something that I felt like I could not do. Now, I've thought about it over and over. And I even said it to my wife now. I said, you know, it was kind of crazy. It was stupid. It was silly because I know I could have gone to them. And, you know, they would have done whatever they could to help me, you know. But rather, you know, I did something crazy and I hurt them worse than actually if I had, you know, gone to them and said, this is what my situation is. But that's just the way things are.
Yeah, especially being like a man and that pride and that ego. Sometimes you really need life to kick you in the ass to finally be like, okay, you know, I can't just be doing this because is that an ego in us, especially guys. We have that biggest struggle with that ego because we're the man. I'm supposed to be the man. But sometimes you are the man. You could ask for help. You're still the man if you ask. Mm-hmm. And like with your case, you went to prison. You went to jail, and that really gave you that swift kick in the ass where it's like, okay, you know, I got to let this ego portion of me die because I'm not as high horse as I thought I was. And
that's
if I
right.
keep doing this every year, it seems like my life is getting lower, lower, lower. And now, bang, you're in prison. You don't even have freedom. Now you're making license plate for a living that says live free or whatever. And you're starting to get license plate and it says live free. And you're like, I'm cooped up in here, you know, and that really messes you with you even more. So now, if you don't mind touching up on James, like your whole prison experience, like I know a lot of people, I've talked to a handful of my patients that have been in prison, and after prison, they refound God, or they then finally kind of calmed down and they took like a different look at life and different perspective, and they became a better person. Of course, they regret doing what they have done. I wish they would have learned how to get to this place without prison, but sometimes that's just how life is. You just have to go through this, I guess, negative and saddening and hardening experience to kind of come out. Because some of us, we're stubborn and it takes us a harder kick in the ass to really learn that lesson versus somebody else, you know, that might just go through something real small and then, okay, then they learn a lesson. Sometimes we just go through life in our own way. So can you touch base upon a little bit of your prison experience and what really made you then join the seminary, I believe it's called, right, and become a pastor?
Well, mine took a little different turn. See, after this happened to me, I was out on bond for almost 6 months. But when it first happened to me, because of it happened suddenly like it did, everybody thought that I'd had a mental breakdown. So my lawyer and the judge, and you got to understand, I'm in a small town practice law. Everybody knows me. Okay. So this was out of the ordinary for a lawyer and for me specifically. So nobody could understand it. And everybody thought that something had to have clicked mentally to make me do that. So the judge ordered me, who I knew very well, ordered me to have 6 months at Dorothy Dix Miller Hospital. I stayed there for 3 weeks, and I got out. When I came back out, I didn't have a job because I knew I couldn't go back to the law office. Then trying to figure out what I was going to do, and I had some friends, because obviously I had a lot of people who were doing things, businesses. One friend had a service station, and he said, well, you can come on and help me out. So I went over and helped him out, pump gas, wash windshields. At that time, that's what you did, okay? Clients of mine, people who knew me well, would come by. They would talk to me, pray with me. I washed their windshields, pumped the gas for them. Eventually, I left there. Now, I want you to follow me because I'm out for about 6 months, okay? Eventually, I left there and started working at a supermarket for another gentleman, a white gentleman who had been the chairman of the county commissioner. Knew me very well. He gave me a job. He said, well, I don't have anything, but if you want to work, you know, as a cash behind the, it was a word for what we used there, but in a way, a bad boy. If you want to work as a bad boy to bag the groceries and take them out to the cars, you can, and no problem. I'll let you do that. So I said, okay, I'm fine with it. I didn't mind it. I worked behind the cashier. We bagged the groceries for clients, customers who came in, walked them to the car. Some of them were my clients. Some of them were friends. Some were family. Note that I'm still in the county now where I was practicing law now. So I want you to forget that. And so that became such a very humbling experience. You know, it was like, wow, I thought I was all up here, and look what I'm doing now. You know, I'm carrying groceries of my former clients to the cars with them, but they're praying with me. And so it began to really, change my whole outlook and pattern on life. I started praying. My mom, who was now down from New York and who had been living with me for some time now, And I don't know, there was something started working with me, and I started praying, and I felt a call to the ministry. And I eventually went and talked to my pastor, and he talked with me, and I told him, I said, in the Missionary Baptist Church, the concept is that we do an initial sermon, okay? And so I told him, I said, well, I feel the call, but I don't want to do the initial sermon until I get out. I'd already made my mind up that I was going to plead guilty. I was going to do whatever was coming my way and get it all behind me, because I knew that my life has changed. I was no longer that person. And so he said to me, he said, well, look, if you feel the call, why don't you go ahead on and do your initial sermon? Because you don't know. The Lord might have something for you to do while you're confined. And so he encouraged me to do my initial sermon. I did that sermon on that Sunday, the first Sunday in January. This happened to me in July. The first Sunday in January, I did my initial sermon. And that following Monday, I went to court, and I was given a 15-year sentence. May not believe this, but I know it hurt my mom, because I hear that when she screamed out in the back. But for me, I was okay. I just felt like I was going to get through this. Everything was going to be okay. I was going to get all the time behind me. And literally, it did. I was the most blessed person confined. I tell my wife right now, confinement, I know, added 5 years to my life. You know, I also tell her, and I think it took 5 years off my mom's life, but it added 5 years to my life. So I worked in the education department as an adult teacher, as an adult assistant, you know, adults to the adults there. I was also helped out in their chaplain's office. I was in Asheville, Kentucky, and this might be hard to believe, but I was such a model prison until I got two furloughs, both working with Prison Fellowship. I went to Stylistown, Pennsylvania for a whole week. I went back to D.C. for another whole week. The time that I went to D.C., they even allowed me to leave out by myself, catch the plane, and come back. They trusted me that well to do that. I was such a model prison until they wouldn't even let other inmates know where I was gone. They thought I went back to court. Okay? I was at seminar, okay, with Prison Fellowship. That's just how well my confinement went. So when everybody talks about, you know, you can't make it, I went through confinement 5 years, 4 years in Ashland and 1 year at in Petersburg in the camp without any infraction whatsoever. None. My record was perfect. And of course, I got out a little early, because, at that time, if you served a third of your time with good behavior, we were able to get out. And so I went to the camp. I left Ashland, Kentucky, went to the camp, Petersburg, and then left there early and came to the Hanway House. And from there, that's where my life started. I then enrolled in seminary. The first time I applied for seminary, I didn't get accepted. I knew why. I didn't get upset. You know, I knew why they didn't accept me. You know, they saw criminal record. But I say, you know, I'm not going to let this stop me. I applied the second year, and I think then they thought I was really serious, and they accepted me. Okay, so I was in seminary. In the process of all this, I remarried to my wife now, and I was only able to go part time. So, but in the in between all of that time, I got my call to the church that I had just spent 32 years with. And, of course, a friend of mine told me about what I had gone through. And he said, you know what you need to do? You need to apply to the state bar and see if you could become a sponsor of CLE. So you have a great story. I think lawyers, they just know, you know, what you have gone through. And I think you can be an inspiration to them. We had one other lawyer in the state of North Carolina who was disbarred, who had a felony record that they allowed to do CLE. It was a white gentleman, only one. But his crime was embezzlement. You know, most lawyers who go through something, that's what it ends up being, you know, embezzlement, taking clients money or what have you.
Is that like laundering money or is that taking money under the table? What is embezzlement?
No, embezzlement is clients' money that you use after you sell a case or something. You're supposed to have it in trust or you mess with trust money. You know, it's misappropriation of funds, really. That's what it boils down to. And so he had gotten charged with that, spent some time with that, but they allowed him to do CLE. So I told my friend, I said, well, I don't know that they'll let me do this because... my crime was a violent one, and I don't know if they allow me to. He said, well, you got a great story. So I came back, talked to my wife, and my wife told me, she said, well, you don't have your license anyway. You don't have anything to lose, which was really a perfect thing to say to me. So I went on to apply. And after applying, they sent back a letter saying that I would hear from them within 3 weeks. 3 weeks came out of your thing. In my mind, I know that all they could see was an African-American guy who had robbed a bank, and that wasn't a good picture, okay? I'm just telling you, what, you know, how I am. That wasn't a good picture. So I got my haircut. I put on my three-piece suit. I got dressed, killed, so to say, you know, so we say, and I went over to the state bar, and I asked to see someone and continue legal education, and they sent someone down, and I could tell when the person looked at me that the whole demeanor changed, you know, and she said, we talked, and she said, Miss Smith, you will hear something from us within the next 3 days. The next 3 days, I got my letter, and it says, we are glad to inform you that you've been approved as a sponsor of continuing legal education for the North Carolina State Bar. Only two, and I was one of those, who were disbarred and was able to be a sponsor of continuing legal education and ethics, mental health, and substance abuse in the state of North Carolina. I wrote all over North Carolina teaching lawyers for 11 years and probably would still be doing it now if COVID hadn't come in. I stopped when COVID came in. That's how I'm where I am. I just believe that if you continue to try. And that's one thing my wife, my mom told me when I first got out. She said, you go lie down in a ditch if you want to. You can put your head in the sand if you want to. All folk going to do is come by and put more dirt on you and rub your head further in the sand. But if you would just get out, these same people will give you a helping hand. I took it to heart, and here I am now.
And James, going through your whole life, any words of advice for people that are maybe struggling, maybe are kind of feel stuck in life? I know you had a lot of learning lessons, but if you were to give like a piece of advice to anybody out there struggling or having a hard time, what do you think it would be?
Well, I always tell people, number one, to stay focused. Most time we lose our focus. That's what happened to me. I lost my focus. I got into the gambling and kind of just lost who I was and what I was all about, you know. And I also tell people that if you're going through something, you know, just kind of understand that the darkest hour is just before dark. You know, so you can, you don't have to get stuck there. You don't have to stay there, you know. And especially if you have an issue like I had, you know, you got to come to grips with it. You know, got to just confront the source. You know, look, this is what I did. And I know I shouldn't have done it. You know, you got to accept responsibility for it. And you got to, you know, keep moving on, you know. And you can't let your circumstance be an excuse. You know, you just got to, look, I messed up. That's what I said to myself. Look, I messed up. I tell people that right now. You know, I've said it. And you got to be honest. I want to make certain of that. You got to be honest and forthright and don't mind sharing. Because if people see that you're honest and you're forthright and you don't mind sharing, they begin to trust you. And people wonder, you know, how did you get a church? And you pastor a special, you know, conservative Missionary Baptist church. That would be the last church, you know, would call you as a pastor. How did you do that? You know, with all you got. And it was because I didn't hold back. You know, I said, this is what I've done. This is where I've been. But I'm a different person now, you know. And I was upfront. I was honest. And they saw it in me. And, of course, you know, I stayed there for 32 years. And I tell people that all the time. That's what you got to do. And, you know, I told you, well, when I did my second book, how I talked about, you know, don't be afraid to fail, you know, because that was my big problem. I was afraid to fail, you know. But if I just had gone to the bottom and just worked my way back up, I would have been much better off. But I thought I could just, you know, do it my way, and that's what best be up.
Yeah, and then James, you mentioned some books that you wrote. Where are these books available, or do you have a website you can pick them up on Amazon? Where can people get the books? And also, if they want to reach out to you, can they find you on any kind of Instagram or social media accounts? If you just plug that in as well, thank you.
Yeah, they can contact me from my website, which is www.dealbyb.com. And on my website, you can even purchase a T-shirt. That's my logo, Deal By Me logo here, you see. Deal By Me logo here. And, of course, this is what I do. My books are also on my website. I've got three books that's on my website. I got Deal By Me, A Golden Opportunity to Blow, and Deal By Me, Second Edition, a Self-Evaluation. And I got another book that's Come Let Us Reason Together. In the midst of all the time that I've been out, I have to tell you how my ministry grew, because I served as president of the Interdenomination Ministerial Alliance of Durham and Vicinity, is where I practice at. I served as moderator of our association that consists of over 43 churches at the time. I've also served as moderators for the General Baptist State Convention of the whole state of North Carolina, over all moderators. So that's where my ministry has taken me. So all of this is available on my website. You can purchase my books on Amazon.com, and you can also purchase them from my website. Anybody who wants a book autographed needs to get it from my website. I'll autograph it, send it to you, and of course, you don't even have to pay shipping costs. I'll just do that free of charge.
Awesome. Thank you so much, James. I really appreciate you coming on the show. I'm sure a lot of people have learned from your experience and your life. And I want to once again thank you just for being open and honest with everything you went through, because you've definitely had some highs, had some lows, and your whole life reads like a book almost, you know, in a sense. So I really appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you so much, James.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Oh, I gotta go. I've been working, told him please don't hit my phone. I'm in my zone, bruh, just leave me alone. Was on the road, but I swear I'm coming home. Now the drinks on me, I think we need a toast. See, I did it for me. Now my